Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on a Jupiter and Mars.
Hello and welcome to Season 2, Episode 12 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us of today's special topic.
It is a special topic, Steve. It's we're taking advantage of the end of the calendar year and the start of the new year to, step back from our usual episodic approach to things and look back on the shows that we've covered in 2023, look ahead to some of the missions that we are anticipating in 2024. And, I should mention that we're always open and welcoming other suggestions for topics as well. Why don't I do an update, Steve, before we get around to talking about the year that's been and the year ahead? So we have one that's quite interesting. It's about some secret asteroid mining that is coming up in 2024, we believe, from the stories that we've read. It's an interesting story, and it touches on a number of the themes that we've already explored, like mining in space and space law. But here's the wrinkle, and it's all about secrecy. So there is a firm called Astroforge, and it acknowledges that it's planning a new mission to a nearby asteroid, but it won't say which asteroid it has in its sights. There's no guarantee of it going there this year, but it certainly is beginning to look that way. We'll just have to wait and see. The company hopes to grab and return valuable metals from this asteroid, but it's worried about starting a proverbial gold rush. If it clarifies which asteroid it's going to, it's afraid other companies are going to leap in there and beat them to it. And in fact, Steve, there are plenty of new startups from the United States, Europe, and elsewhere. And for the most part, these companies are all hoping and planning to hitch a ride on one of the reusable SpaceX rockets from Elon Musk's company. So although mission secrecy is contra to the United Nations Space Treaty, the Astroforge won't be the first one to cross that line. That notoriety goes to an Israeli-built lunar lander that crashed on the moon back in 2019. Now, this is an incredible bit of history that I don't think many people knew about. Only after the crash did we learn that that lander was carrying scientific experiments involving thousands of microscopic animals called tardigrades. Without any public scrutiny, a private company sent life from Earth to the moon to see how it would cope on the lunar surface, knowing that these tardigrades are incredibly hardy. But I'm afraid to say, Steve, that with this new under-the-radar news bite that we've been talking about, the barn door to space is already open.
That's a pretty shocking thing when you think about it. I, too, have only just recently read about the tardigrades that were sent to the moon. It's kind of disheartening.
It is disheartening, Steve, that these remarkable things, which, you know, in some ways we can say we would all be fascinated by, but to have them going on under an explicit veil of secrecy, I think it's disappointing and somewhat alarming.
Speaking of secrecy, Tim, the United States Space Force is about to launch the secret X-37B unmanned space plane. And yes, that's what they call it, a space plane. And the Chinese are about to do the same thing with their secret space plane. So nobody really knows what they're up to, but we do know that the X-37 is going to be launched upon a Falcon Heavy. And so who knows what new things the military has planned for those. And also, speaking of the Falcon reusable rockets, just yesterday, the most used reusable rocket in Elon Musk's fleet had a crash landing. So that most reusable rocket is no more in the fleet. So that's too bad about that.
So let's move on to this discussion about some of the past Space Talks episodes in the past year. And we've covered an enormous amount of ground, lots of science, talked about lots of exploration, and some totally bizarre and hard to understand knowledge that both of us have found a bit of a struggle to comprehend. But I wanted to start this particular episode then with a fairly obvious question, I think. When you think back about the shows that we've done, is there anything that comes to mind as being, I don't know, particularly surprising to you based on, you know, where you started?
Well, you know, Tim, as we mentioned before, both you and I had a certain amount of referent knowledge about space and space-related items. But I think the most surprising thing to me after we began season one and season two now and doing the research that we do for each and every topic is the amount that I didn't know. Really about the only thing that I had a really good handle on that hasn't changed too much would be constellations. But as we researched into dark matter and dark energy, for example, those were a couple of terms which tripped easily off my tongue, but I really didn't have much of an understanding. And now having done the research for it, that was a real surprise to me.
Yeah, that's right. There's a kind of mind-boggling process where if you start to pay attention to news streams that are covering stories about what's happening in space and research on any topic, really, you start to get these really enormous streams of insights and reports that are routinely followed by a small number of people that are keeners, but they're readily accessible to us. Then you find yourself reading about things that just make you want to shake your head. And for me, I would say I had no idea about the amount of exploration going on in space. The idea of retrieving rocks from asteroids and dropping them off like this, like a milk run from the 20th century. So there you're learning about whether it's the science of dark matter or the incredible initiatives being taken by countries like India and Japan. I just hadn't been paying enough attention, I guess.
I totally agree, Tim. And speaking of details, for example, on the very last Elon Musk attempt to launch Starship, I didn't really realize or understand the complexity of hot staging, where the first stage takes off and then typically those engines shut down when they've used up their propellant and then they discard the first stage and then they light up the second stage. That's called cold staging. I didn't realize that when you do that, of course, and if you see the interior pictures of the Apollo astronauts when that happens, so they're pushed back into their seats as they're thrust upwards. And when that first stage cuts off, they're suddenly jammed forward into their harnesses because the force, the upward force, is suddenly stopped. And so, yes, they're continuing upwards, but not with the same momentum they had before. So they're jammed forward. Well, not only are they jammed forward, but so is all the fuel in the second stage. And so it jostles back and forth, sort of like if you have water in a bottle and it starts jostling back and forth. And so you have to have very good fuel pumps that push that jostling fuel downward so it can go into the injectors and start up the second stage. Hot boosting means that you just keep on going. And while you're still going upwards and burning the first stage, the second stage ignites. So you don't have to have the complexity of very superior fuel boosters to push the fuel down and get to the igniters. I had no idea of that.
You mentioned the Elon Musk aspect of this, and that's another topic that I wanted to touch on here, is how often in the past year we found ourselves not particularly wanting to, but needing to talk about some of the innovations and some of the histrionics and achievements and failures of that man and his company. It's the going to hot staging is something that they turned around in, I think, about 3 or 4 months. They had not planned to use hot staging, but when they launched and had their initial rocket blow up, they quickly turned around and said, we need a new methodology. And they did that. You know, all these spacecraft that are going here and there are hitching rides on a private sector company. Now, just a minute ago, you mentioned the secret launch, the secret missions, sending up the spacecraft on one of Elon Musk's spacecraft. So there is a partnership of a government and a private sector company operating a mission in secrecy together, not just the government on its own, but in collaboration with a private sector company.
SpaceX has really, as you said, revolutionized the commercialization of space. It's utterly amazing.
You've often tracked down some pretty wild audio recordings, and they've really helped me feel good about giving people something special to hear. It's something unusual. For example, you found an audio of a Russian spacecraft entering the Venetian atmosphere. And of course, on the flip side of that Sirius, you found the Abbott and Costello Lost in Space. So I'm kind of curious, like, how do you go about doing that? I mean, are ideas pop in your head? Are they references? And you're finding these on YouTube, I presume.
It is topic driven. And then just like space foam and virtual particles pop in and out of space, these ideas pop into my mind and I'll just go searching for them on YouTube just to see if there's something out there. And yes, I will say that of all of the sound bites that we've had this year, the one that really surprised me the most was the Russian Venera landings and the sound of the lens caps popping off. The atmosphere was very harsh, and so they had very protective lenses over their microphones and the their video cameras. And those lenses had to be popped off with a small explosive charge. And so in the one particular one that we played, we found the sound clip, and you can hear it in the background, of the lens being popped off. Well, one of the lenses continually failed on mission after mission. So it's kind of interesting to hear the pop, and then we know that it's a failure. So
that was a recording that you found that was dating back to, was it the 70s or 80s?
Yes, it was back to the 70s. And I'm sure very, very few people out there have ever heard of that. I mean, yes, we've heard astronauts in space. We've, you know, from Apollo 8, the first time they went around the moon and so forth. But this was really a hidden gem.
Well, well done, and keep at it. Now, I wanted to talk about one of the topics that's shown up a few times over the course of the past year is space tourism. And there's a lot of it, and there are plans for a lot more of it. And it seems to me that, I don't know, we're at some kind of a turning point on this, even though it's still under the radar. At least that's my thinking. Have you got a take on that? Do you think we're about to see a significant uptick in that regard?
I was wrong in predicting this success of Madonna to my daughter at the time. I called her a flash in the pan, wouldn't last a year. So, Tim... My track record on predictions is pretty bad. Personally, I don't see John Q. Public spending any sums of money to go into space, no.
The private sector companies are talking, I don't know, about $50 million in that ballpark. But, you know, this Starship that that Elon Musk is trying to get in orbit safely and so on, I believe I read that they're hoping to take something like 100 people on board that spacecraft. So that, even if it's still, significant numbers of millions of dollars, it rules out, you know, you and me and our neighbors, so to speak. But it probably starts to open the door to more people. I guess a comparison would be, if you think about the early years of air travel, you know, who got to go on those first flights across the Atlantic? Now, I actually don't know the answer to that question, but they weren't the average citizen. It would have been a relatively expensive proposition.
And if I can just add one little bit of interest to that, we know that on a commercial flight, there's a manifest, a passenger manifest, and the names are down there. So let's just say that something happens or whatever, flights are delayed. The airlines know who's on board that flight. Well, the same thing is supposed to happen with space flights. A manifest of all the passengers and the crew has to be published beforehand. However, when Jeff Bezos went up the first time, he did not publish the manifest. We didn't know who was on board until they landed, and apparently that was a legal faux pas. But the penalties for that are who knows what? Who's the enforcement agency? It's my understanding that because the flight occurred in the States, the FAA would say you didn't have a manifest, you must do so in the future. And then, as you mentioned before, they'll just simply launch from a country that doesn't require a manifest. So
there's always going to be an out for these companies if they're trying to pursue the almighty buck. And I wanted to compare the space race from the 60s with what we see going on today, because we've certainly spoken of it in a number of issues. But we did do one episode where we talked about the original space race involving the United States and the Soviet Union. But things have changed pretty dramatically, and there is a space race going on again, it seems, in terms of mining in space and getting to the moon and getting to Mars. And but that duality between the United States and Russia is definitely not part of it. It's an interesting transition, isn't it?
The international race for the moon is on. And as you said, the private ventures to the moon are beginning as well.
So we've got this transition in countries with, and I think one of the interesting little points that happened fairly close, tight together this last year was the Russians had sent a spacecraft, a lunar lander, a rover or something, and it crashed on arrival at the lunar surface. And it happened within about a month of the Indian government successfully landing on the moon. No one would have imagined India being in the space race in the 1960s, that's for sure.
And they did it on a shoestring budget. So hats off to them.
There's one event coming up in 2024, at least we're crossing our fingers and hoping that this does come to pass. And it's the NASA Artemis II mission, which is going to return human flight to the moon. So here we are, all these years since the Apollo program. My question or curiosity is, what do you think is going to be the same or different about the impact should that flight take place? Now, there is a Canadian on board, will be on board that flight. But just in general, do you think anyone's going to really care close to what they did back in the 60s? And if not, why not?
I don't think that there's a chance that anybody is going to be enamored with Artemis II as they were with Apollo 8. However, that's not to say that a landing on the moon wouldn't garner interest. I think that will for Artemis 3. Should Artemis 3 not be beaten by one of those other rival countries at this point in time? And let's take a look ahead to events that we're expecting in 2024. Tim, we've had a busy year of space exploration in 2023, and it's surely going to continue in the new year. Do you have any showstoppers that might be coming up?
So in January, the next spacecraft being commissioned by Axiom is going to be taking some astronauts to the International Space Station. Now, this is a company with some pretty fantastic and huge ambitions. They're actually planning to build their own privately operated space station. In the meantime, they're ramping up their track record by taking people on commercial trips to the International Space Station. This is going to be their third time using a Falcon X to carry people, paying customers, I should say. And we understand those paying customers are coughing up about $50 million per seat per person.
Well, you know, Tim, prior to this year, I didn't even know about Axiom. It's not a household name. That's in part due to the fact it's not owned by billionaires like Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos, but the company is making waves in other ways. Isn't this mission really a money grab? Isn't that right?
Well, it's going to be a couple of years before they launch their first segment of the new space station. And initially, it will also be hooked up to the ISS. But I think they're in a kind of a proving ground or mode right now. So right now they're training their own pilots, for example. But the next flight is going to be commanded by a former NASA astronaut, Michael Lopez Alegria. And he's going to be commanding what they call the AX-1 mission that will go up in April. Now, I think one of the most interesting aspects of this particular flight is going to be that Axiom is reusing the very same Falcon 9 rocket and the very same Crew Dragon space capsule that they used in a mission a year ago. And I think that's quite something.
It is. That's got to be a real cost reduction right there. And I believe there's another January flight that's going to be a first, and that's called Dream Chaser. And that's a good name for any kind of a spaceship. Also, there's going to be a trip to the ISS, and this spacecraft is operated by Sierra Space. And it's been in development for a long time, since about 2010. Dream Chaser is designed with fold-up wings so it can fit inside a sleeve atop a rocket. And in January, that will be the United Launch Alliance Centaur rocket. In a best-case scenario, each Dream Chaser should last about 15 flights.
Let's get away from the low Earth orbit missions, Steve, and mention the Japanese Space Agency's plan for 2024. Now, they are hoping to use a new H-3 rocket, they call it, to launch their MMX ship, which stands for Martian Moons Exploration. Now, that could happen in September if all goes well, but they have to get a successful test of the H-3 rocket first. Part of the cargo on this will be a small rover destined for delivery to Phobos. It's a moon that orbits Mars. And of course, most of us are not that familiar with Phobos. It's the largest of the two Martian moons, but it's tiny. It's just 1/100th the size of our own moon.
You know, Tim, with all these things going on, I'm going to have to make up a spreadsheet or at least a couple of pieces of paper, one for trips to the moon, one for trips to asteroids, another one for Martian trips, and just to try to see as a Venn diagram how they all mesh in together. It's all getting too much for me.
And as some people say, you can't tell the players without a program. It's not just the United States or NASA anymore. And speaking of that, what about the Chinese? Aren't they? They're itching to get up there too, are they not?
They are. And you know, Tim, I think we're going to have to do an entire episode on the Chinese space program. because they have lofty ambitions for space, and in 2024, they're indeed going back to the moon with a mission to the South Pole. China has previously landed spacecraft on the lunar surface, and in fact, they've stated an intention to send their astronauts called Taikonauts by the end of this decade. Not only that, they plan to establish an international lunar research station on the moon.
International? You know, I can't think, frankly, of any past collaborative space missions involving China. Am I right on that?
Absolutely right. They keep secret their launches, their orbital paths, and so on, which is contrary to the UN Outer Space Treaty. So I think it's just public relations at this time, Tim.
The participants for this space lunar research station, at least from a PR standpoint, Steve, they put out press releases saying that the new countries involved would be Pakistan, Azerbaijan, and Belarus. And earlier in the year, they mentioned that South Africa and Venezuela. So it's a lot about the politics, I think, back here on Earth.
But the biggest headline we're expecting in 2024, with our fingers crossed, has got to be when NASA launches Artemis II. And one of those four astronauts will be the Canadian Jeremy Hansen. Now, as we speak, that launch is scheduled for November 16th. But hey, the previously mentioned X-37 launch in December has had three launch windows. So there's a lot of steps that need to be taken before that liftoff occurs. I'd put the odds of this happening in 2024 as maybe 50-50 at best.
You know, that mission is going to get a lot of attention, at least in one country, and that's Canada. The idea of having a Canadian astronaut, the first non-American to visit the moon, that's a pretty big deal. And I know politics isn't our speciality, but you have to think that somewhere in the Prime Minister's office at 24 Sussex in the home of Justin Trudeau, there are some people thinking about a photo op involving some of these opportunities to get some attention, because there'd be lots of Canadian interest. But as you know, Steve, there's no politics in space talks. So we're going to get on to plans that we have for space talks in 2024. I don't know if that's a perfect segue, but let's talk a little bit about some of the shows that we have in mind that we're starting to think about and frame for the coming months.
Well, I know that there's one that I really want to do, and that's about exotic stars and fast radio bursts. Up until a couple of years ago, I'd never heard of magnetars, and I came across it in an article, and I said, magnetars, what are those? Now, I remember learning about neutron stars, pulsars, in the early 70s in a couple of university courses I was taking. Quasars were mentioned at the time, but they really didn't know what they were. And those are quasi-stellar radio sources. Well, wouldn't we now know what quasars are? So a topic on exotic stars is one that I'm looking forward to.
I really enjoyed a couple of the episodes that we've done on the planets. And the reason I enjoyed them is I learned a heck of a lot about how different they are one from another. And, you know, I think I grew up with this notion that there was one planet that had everything going for it and the rest were just a big pile of rocks. And it almost didn't matter. And you've talked about these different kinds of exotic stars. The range of possibilities is really fascinating, and how they work and why they exist. And strangely enough, there's even a great deal I'm finding anyway about we're going to be talking about Saturn. I've done some initial research, and I'm going to let in a little secret here, sort of foreshadowing. We're not going to be able to see the rings of Saturn next year. At some point in the year, they're going to disappear. Now, shall I explain that, or should we leave it for listeners to find out about later down the road? What do you think?
Well, let's leave it for later, but let's just say that in the 70s, when I was taking those courses, we went up on the roof of the university and took a look at Saturn. And at that time, the rings were edge on. So they're coming again.
You've given it away. You've given it away. What about space stations? That's another one that we're going to tackle and I'm looking forward to. You know, there's Mir has been a space station of significance in our history, as is the International Space Station, which is coming up for the tail end. It's on the back nine, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. We've mentioned earlier this episode, Axiom has got its plans for a private space station. And one of the modules that they're going to be launching is going to be a studio to make movies. So you've got some pretty bizarre space station stories ahead. And there's also the whole notion of using a space station as a permanent habitat for people. So that should be an interesting episode that I'm looking forward to. How about another one for you?
Well, obviously, misconceptions about space. As a kid watching all those great science fiction movies as a 9 and 10 year old and so on, we believe certain things would happen and would be that way, and then we find out that they aren't. So I'm looking forward to dealing with misconceptions about being in space. From a physics point, I'd like to do one, I think, on light and time. I just found out something really fascinating about photons. And so I think we have to delve into what are photons. Certainly, I have a tremendous misconception of what they were from, let's say, the 1970s and 80s as to what they are, and also how it relates to time. So that's going to be a fun one, I think.
Oh, absolutely, because it'll get a chance for us to actually say in a serious conversation that we're talking about the space-time continuum. Like, it comes up in so many sci-fi stories. And I chuckled to myself thinking, like, well, just how easy is it to have a break in the space-time continuum? Because I've read about it, I don't know how many hundreds of times, or seen it in episodes of, I don't know, Star Trek and what have you. It's a phenomenon that is so obtuse to the human mind that it lends itself to some pretty wild speculation. But we're not going to speculate. We're going to tell it like it is.
Well, we are. Another one I'm looking forward to is doing a, shall we say, a longitudinal discourse on James Webb and its findings, and particularly the beginnings of the universe. And we've mentioned this already in one of our episodes about the Big Bang and so on. But now there's more and more evidence that there were two Big Bangs, if not three, and what preceded them, and the courses of acceleration. And the images that James Webb has come up with showing that galaxies are much, much more refined and formed in their shape than they should be, according to our current theory. So that's going to be interesting to just keep track of that as it goes along.
You know, I think one of the things we've learned over the course of the last year is that the incoming knowledge, the stream of it, the certainty of new understanding, new mysteries and new understanding, you have to take a calm approach to what we believe, knowing that it's probably temporal, that there's a lifespan for how long that particular explanation is going to hold up. And so I don't know, is it frustrating or is it just an additional sense of wonder when you look up in the sky and you can enjoy it, even if you admit to yourself that we only know so much and we're not likely ever to know the full story? It's, I don't know, maybe it contributes to a sense of wonder. I'm not sure, but I think that's probably all the time we have to talk about the shows that we're planning for the new year, but we're both excited about that. But that's all the time we have, Steve. So here we are. This is Tim Woods in Brentwood Bay and
Stephen Lowry in Salmon Arm saying so long. And we'll see you next time on
Space Talks.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring brings.